Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And I hope you've enjoyed the second edition of the... It wasn't a full edition because it was Memorial Day. And so I hope you enjoyed the second edition. And we're going to be getting back into content and back into the ratification debates as we, you know, plow towards the first day of summer. And we'll probably be in Virginia for quite a while because these are very extensive debates. And so we're going to just dive into this. I don't want to necessarily go through, you know, any other side notes. We will pick up where we left off with Feedback Friday on Friday and then back into the presidential positions and so forth. But we do have Paul Venable. And so, Paul, welcome back.
Hey, GR. If I can comment, I really enjoyed your show yesterday. I think what happens is that we really don't know the depth of constitutional power that we have and that those who take the oath have. And your show is a great example of, you know, pointing out things that we don't haven't even been on our paradigm. So I just want to compliment you. I really enjoyed that show yesterday.
Great, great. Now, are you playing a harp back there? Or
I just muted my laptop.
Oh, okay. All right.
Outside sounds anymore.
I just thought maybe you had a little lap harp and you were just, you know, anyway. So before we dive into Virginia, I know we have talked in the past about sovereign citizens. I know we've talked about general assemblies and all of these types of things. And you know I'm writing an article. As a matter of fact, this article regarding the counties matter most. And right. The reason why counties matter most is because of the type of government that we have. And, you know, I know that you're constantly confronting, because I've had Bill Hermiston, so I can actually say that. I've had him on the show, and he's driving the General Assembly, these other sovereign citizens. As a matter of fact, I engaged the sovereign citizen movement in Wyoming. And as I look at what these people are doing, they're actually convinced. So anybody that understands the type of government we have, we are to have a Republican form of government. And so when you look at this article, when I finally get it done, you're going to understand that as our lowest level of representation, it is critical. And as a matter of fact, I'm pointing out why this is also critical, because in a representative government, our representatives are to actually be our guardians. They're actually to stand up and interpose to the state level. They're to stand up and interpose to the federal level. And when we look at a general assembly, how in the heck is the general assembly a representative government? It's a democracy. In other words, it's not granting the power, or it's not instituting a government, it's instituting a democracy. Does that make sense?
Seemingly. Let me hear you mean.
I'm sorry. What you just said wasn't very legible for me on my end. So could you repeat what you said?
Seemingly, because the people that are part of a county assembly, I would think are only representing themselves and not the rest of the people. But tell me if you could, you know, detail that a little more.
Okay, so when we institute a government, based on the framework of what the framers gave us, and here's the problem with counties. We marginalize counties. If the Declaration of Independence and if Thomas Jefferson is correct, that governments are instituted by men or by the people, then when we created a county government, we should have used a constitution, and we should have, because in this new form of government, in our new form of government, we do not have a king. We have a divided government that is divided into three branches. See, under a monarchy, you have a magistrate that has all the power. He's the executive, he's the legislative, and he's the judiciary. And so the doctrine of magistrate means that it, within one person, they basically hold all of this power. Now, in our form of government, they actually broke it into three branches. Now, what you see void of in all of these attempts by the Jural Assembly, by the sovereign citizen, is you don't see, and you do not recognize any of that device, the division of the magistrate. In other words, we do not see the separations of powers existing in the government. And we should have actually created this in our county government, so that our county would have had an executive, a legislative, and obviously it had the judiciary, because each county has a court and a judge or a group of judges. And so depending on, you know, how big the population of the county is. I mean, if it's very sparse, it may only be one judge. So when we look at how we broke away from the monarchy, the concept of the people being able to bond together to rise up actually went away, because we actually have representation at all three levels of our government. We have representation at the federal government because we elect our own representative in the House of Representatives. It's not very well done, which is why my presidential positions has been, you know, spelling it all out, that we need to get back to proper representation and proper apportionment. Now, when we look at the state government, we have a House of Representatives. That is the group of people that is to represent us, the people, in the state. Within our county, within our respective county, we're to have our representative who represents us, the people, in our county. And then in our county, we choose our representatives. Now, currently, there are some counties that actually have a democracy. And what I mean by that is all the representatives are elected by all of the people. Technically, what should happen is the county should be divided. If you have three, at a minimum, I think most counties have three commissioners. So if you have three commissioners, then you should break your county down into three districts, and the people of each district should vote for their representative, because that's how you maintain this balance and these checks. Because what ends up happening in the county, if you happen to have a large town in your county, that town is going to dictate everything. Unless you actually divide things to where you have a different district over, you know, the different areas of people. So you divide up the people by districting, and now you can actually have a true representative to protect the interests of the urban or the rural areas instead of the, you know, the city dominating.
Correct.
And the larger the city, that means that you're going to have even more, because once you get to a certain population level, and I'll give you a good example. Spokane has a couple of different cities, Spokane County, and there's actually two large cities. There's Spokane and there's Spokane Valley. And there's a huge difference between Spokane Valley and Spokane. Spokane Valley, they work on their roads. They get the roads done. They take care of the things that people want. In Spokane, they spend money on social engineering. They had this stupid Camp Hope, where it was a waste of money creating this large area for homelessness, and it was basically a bastion of crime and debauchery, and it was just, it was disgusting. But anyway, as you look at the county and the county commissioners and how they divided it all up, I mean, there's obviously a separation between those who are selecting the representative for Spokane County and those who select the representative for Spokane. The problem is, I think they have two at large and then they have three districts. And I think they ought to break them all down, because when you allow the at large, you allow democracy to creep in. And so it is very, very clear that we're not to have a democratic government. We're to have a Republican form of government using a democratic methodology of choosing our representatives. Now, I would love to see the elections actually go to a greater percentage instead of 50% plus one, because there are close races. And I would like to see those races actually have to go back, you know, those campaigns actually have to go back and truly, because sometimes you'll have the these independents splitting the vote.
Okay.
And so sometimes it could be so close that the wrong person can get elected. And I believe that, you know, we should actually move the margin to where we get 55 or 60%. In other words, you can't necessarily have a winner by 50% plus one.
Right.
By doing that, then you actually force a runoff between the top two. Now, there are a lot of states that just use the top two, and I think the top two is a travesty of representation, because it's important that you actually in the general election allow as many people as possible to pursue their own ideas and to pursue, you know, alternate theories of the best direction to go. You know, this is why we have independent parties and so forth. But nevertheless, if you can't come up with an overwhelming 55 or 60% for the person to win, then it goes into, and then you deal with another runoff. What this would do is it would probably throw a lot more elections into a runoff, to where it really goes down to the top two. And then those top two, you know, basically have to, you know, fight to get to that majority, that significant majority, not just a 50% plus one. I just have a problem with the 50%, because that lends to, and it gets more and more people into this mind model of democracy. And Madison, you know, looked at democracy, and I forget when he said it. It wasn't in the Federalist Papers, but he did speak poorly. He didn't say anything positive about a democracy. It was the most tyrannical government there was.
It's at some point I can find you the quote. I can't find it right away, but.
I have quotes like that, but he quoted at one point in his lifetime that democracy was the most vilest form of government. And so when we broke away, they created a representative government, and the Confederacy of Association, or the Articles of Confederation, and then the Association of Confederation, then it was the Articles of Confederation. So as they migrated from one government to the next government to finally to the Constitution, they broke things down to where they ensured a better representation and checks and balances. Now, I'm going into this, and this is all about the General Assembly. When you look at the General Assembly is literally a democracy, because if they're forming a county government, because what I'd like to see between you and me is I'd actually like to see a way where we could actually have a bicameral legislative body at the county level as well. Which would mean that we would need to break down the county, or if a county actually had a threshold of a certain population, then the county should be formed, the county legislators, the commissioners should have a bicameral legislative body. In other words, you will have the people choose their representatives, and then you would have the government, let's say if it's a city council or what have you, they would choose a representative for the Senate at the county level. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. It does. It is. I see a lot of, that's quite a paradigm, but it makes sense because it actually preserves the benefits, the advantages of a republic.
Right. And so when I look, at these general assemblies, when I look at this sovereign citizen group that I involved myself with, and it was a social media engagement. I mean, these guys were basically saying that 100% of the people have to buy. No person can be compelled to be a part of a government. And what they're basically saying is that if you don't have 100% buy-in, you don't have a government. And what world are they living in? I mean, there's no government that will allow that. At the birth of the next person, they have to buy in or government's disbanded. Are you kidding? I mean, it is so ridiculous, and it is so entrenched in this concept of democracy that, you know, it is anarchical. In other words, it leads to pure anarchy because everybody is a sovereign, and we all should have, you know, the ultimate say on whether we want to do what or not. And if we don't like it, then we don't have to do it. And I'm going, what a, you know. There's some choice words, but bottom line, you're talking about a spoiled little brat, somebody that can't civilly work with somebody else, and they're going to take their own ball, or they're just not going to play with anybody because they just don't like how it panned out for them.
Would you give me the indulgence of giving you James Madison's choice words? It was in Federalist Number 10. It's just a short paragraph.
Yeah, sure.
Yep. Democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention, have ever been found incompatible with personal security or the rights of property, and have in general been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths. That was Madison in Federalist 10.
Sure. Yeah. And I actually cite that. But right. The citation I'm looking for is how he referenced them as the vilest form of government. And that wow. That was outside of the Federalist Papers. It was, you know, it's a pretty potent type of, you know, comment when he talks about it. But it wasn't in that formal writing. Bottom line, when we look at the general assemblies, when we look at these guys, they're not looking to, they actually ignore our Republican form of government. They ignore the fact that we actually do have representatives. And the reason why, and this is critical, the reason why we are at this point of pressure, political pressure, at the state and local levels with these folks, and this is how they're gaining ground, is because our counties have lost representation and their significance. Because of Reynolds v. Sims, because of Baker v. Carr, because the Supreme Court violated the Constitution and unconstitutionally reformed every state in the Union. And what they did was they wiped away the county boundaries and basically forced democracy to form within each of these states. And so the way I see this is that, you know, all they're trying to do is they're basically trying to ignore what government we're supposed to have, and they're using a different democracy, because our problem is democracy right now. In the states, we have a democracy, and our problem is that, or I should say, they are just injecting another form of democracy to combat this other democracy, and this is how it all leads to anarchical chaos. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. It's, yeah. Yeah, it does.
Okay, so...
I think they probably don't understand the depth of what a republic really is and what it should look like. So what we've got is today's paradigm overlaid with this concept of a jural assembly, when they should actually be looking at the constitutional paradigm and trying to reclaim it.
Yeah, so the fact of the matter is the jural assembly existed. It's the same thing with common law courts and common law grand juries being, you know, called for by the people. In other words, under the monarchy, people could form a jural assembly, or people could form a common law grand jury. I mean, the National Liberty Alliance are, you know, have made these assertions, and I think they're finally getting to a point where they're acknowledging, yeah, GR's right. We have a representative government, that this concept of people being able to invoke this, you know, this government purifying process outside of our representation of our government can't be done, because even the NLA basically says you have to use your sheriff. I mean, you know, he represents everybody. And what that means is they're tying, they're perverting two doctrines of the democracy and the monarchical form, or the lesser known magistrate. Because when you look, anybody that says the sheriff is the most powerful person in your county, what they basically are leaning, or they're building their case upon the lesser known magistrate doctrine. And that is a monarchical doctrine. It is not a republican form of government doctrine. Because the sheriff, in the times when the sheriff had that type of authority, that was when we had a monarchy. When we actually created a representative government, the sheriff was no longer the magistrate. We actually created a judge. We actually created a legislative body. So some people say, well, he's the executive. So he had, no, he's not. He's just the cop of the county. He doesn't even do the elections anymore. The counties have moved away from him doing the elections and have basically, you know, created a new position called the auditor that does that, so that he can just basically do policing. His jurisdiction ends based on the border of the county. A true executive has the ability to have emissaries and basically reach out and try to form alliances and offer treaties or trade agreements or what have you. We do not. Okay. Anyway, so this is, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, here's a good one. Now, it's probably not a constitutional body, but I like the point that you make about, you know, an executive can reach out, form treaties and alliances. We've got something called, and I think it's in almost every state, the State Association of Sheriffs.
Uh-huh. Okay. And there's a state, there's the Association of Commissioners as well.
This is probably a subject for another show, but there's a state association of clerks, of sheriffs, of chiefs of police. Then there's a national association of each of these. There's a national association of secretaries of state. I am suspect of all of these associations, but I want to back off of that for a minute, because that's probably a subject or a rat hole for another time. It's just interesting you brought up that point, that an executive has the constitutional authority to reach out and do that, whereas the sheriff is limited to within his own boundaries.
And limited to enforcing the law and the law only. Right.
Sure.
So believe it or not.
Right.
So believe it or not, we've actually spent the full first segment of this show on this topic. Bottom line, though, folks, is that the jural assemblies, the sovereign citizen movement, is basically a facade, and it's all built upon this lie of a democracy. Their premise has nothing to do with our form of government, which is why they're actually leading people down the wrong path. Which, when we come back, what I will do is I will actually break this down once and for all, because this goes back to what ended up happening at the end of the Civil War and the Organic Act. So we'll be right back after this short break, and we'll get into the Virginia ratification debates. We'll be right back after this.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
So let me ask you one question. Who was behind the downfall of America? Or who's behind this? For a long time, we have been under attack by an outside entity that has tried to and has successfully compromised America and slowly has, you know, divided us and divided us and divided us. And the more divisive or the more divided we become, the less effective we become.
So, are you asking who on an earthly level or on a different level?
Oh, so yeah, earthly. Because what I'm
okay.
Go ahead.
Because we've got globalists who are attempting to take down America.
Right.
Who know that it's like America's like this, and the Constitution is. I tell people, my audiences, it's the one thing that stands in the way of complete tyranny throughout the world is the Constitution. They know it, and they want to break it. And it still stands in the way, Chair. There are enough people, even in government, who know that they can't get around it. They're just gonna have to do something to break it.
And right. So,
and I'd say it's globalists.
I see Soros spending a lot of money, and his money is really focused on the progressive side.
Mm-hmm.
He also has some money, or we're finding globalist money involved on the, I'll just say, the conservative side for controlled opposition. And so I honestly see these types of movements being backed by the British Crown, or I should say, if you go back to how the Organic Act came to be, that was all by design of this dark order, this infiltration of agents from Britain into America, in basically coercing and corrupting America and moving us down this path.
Are you talking about the Organic Act of 1871?
Yep, I am. Because that's right. That's really when America, you know, at the core, corrupted itself. And slowly they had to corrupt the people so that the people wouldn't necessarily wake up. But over time, they started bringing in communism. And who was responsible for stopping the biggest threat to communism in the world? Who was responsible for stopping?
For stopping the biggest threat?
The biggest threat to communism, the global communism movement. Who was the biggest threat to that? Hitler. Hitler
was a threat to communism?
Absolutely, because he was going to do it his way. And he did not have an order that was working and had been diligently working for 150 years in creating this plan and executing this plan of slowly migrating and destroying every nation, you know, and their churches and everything, and forming this godless, secular, communist government and world government. In other words, Hitler was going to take, I don't know if Hitler would have taken over the world. He was definitely, a true threat to liberty as well as to the communist movement. He wasn't just a threat to liberty. He was a threat because who actually worked together, Britain, the United States, and Russia, in defeating, and as a matter of fact, Russia was probably the most integral. They had the most to lose.
Russia had the most to lose. Okay, so they'd had their Bolshevik Revolution. All right, they had, and they consolidated all power in what Lenin and pretty much Stalin. Right?
Well, so they had the Politburo, right, which was their body of governing, and then they had a head of state, but.
Right.
The USSR really had the most to lose because if Hitler actually took them over and wiped them out, then, you know, that big gain of this global communist, you know, Cold War state to move every, because the Cold War was the division that we needed on the earth so that people would choose sides. And in the midst and behind all of this, China was being prepared and groomed to actually have its own revolution and to kind of maintain this shroud of secrecy for China to actually come forth, you know, as another dominating player of communism. But communism itself was threatened by World War II.
That had never occurred to me. But... It does make sense to me that communism in China also had to have help. And it had help from right here within the United States, or at least right here from the globalists based in the United States.
Right.
Because it didn't have the skill or technology to do what it's doing today until some of that stuff was given to them.
Okay. So when I look at who could be behind, you know, supporting this movement and helping, you know, fund and keeping people buoyed up in, because who's the audience that is the most susceptible to buying into this BS of the sovereign citizen movement and the General Assembly? Do you think the progressives are going to buy into this? These kids that are part of the Bolshevik Revolution?
You know, the regressives, it's not even on their radar, as far as I know. It's not even on their radar.
So the design of this is actually to attract a very specific demographic. And that demographic happens to be the conservative people.
Well, what it does is it literally, I'll tell you what I've seen. It literally, so let's say that we have a conservative people, minded people who are actually involved in the fight for liberty. And what actually happens to them is they bow out. You know what I mean? They actually bow out of their activity in trying to reclaim the republic, of trying to work with, even with the Constitution, to do what we need to do,
right?
To do the petition. So now this is interesting in the forums that I have met, for example, with Bill Hermanson, okay, in front of an audience. You know, he has listened to my presentation. He says, "Well, do what he does, and then do what we do too." Hang on a minute. Hang on.
Sure.
I just had one step in the office. Can you hang on a minute?
Okay, so let me just, I'm going to continue on then. So what we need to do, what we need to do, folks, is we're going to dive into the Virginia ratification debates. I don't know what's going on Paul's end, but what we need to come to an end on this. We need to kind of create closure. And so this is how I see it, and Paul can hear this when he comes back. Bottom line, it is in somebody always benefits in, you know, trying to move something. And when you see a surge, this is not just about desperation by the people. This is about getting people engaged to actually promote this. So in other words, there has to be somebody on the back end that is actually feeding and providing and organizing this effort in helping people actually become completely ineffective. Because as Paul was just saying, when somebody joins the Jural Assembly, when somebody joins into the sovereign citizen movement and they go down this path of becoming a sovereign citizen, they have become utterly useless to the patriotic movement. They are no longer capable of voting. They shouldn't be able to vote. They shouldn't be able, because they're now claiming allegiance to another form of government. They've completely abandoned our constitutional framework.
I'm back, GR.
Yeah, so
shouldn't be able. GR, they don't want to vote. They think the system is so corrupt that they actually.
You missed my point, and you need to listen to it. Because right. Bottom line, it comes down to this. They have been basically co-opted by a dark, nefarious force that is trying to get them to become completely ineffective and inoperable. In other words, it's, you know, you don't have to kill somebody to make them completely ineffective. All you have to do is convince them that this is what they need to do, and that now you've made them ineffective. And they are no longer capable of fighting and basically working to reclaim the republic. It is just as maniacal as what the Bolsheviks are doing. And as a matter of fact, I see these folks, and I can't emphasize this enough. If we win this war in America and we start deporting people, we need to deport these people. Those people who have crossed that line, those people who have abandoned the Constitution, they need to be deported. Just like the people, because they're equally culpable. They're equally culpable as the communists who are trying to overthrow our Constitution. These people have abandoned it equally. Does that make sense?
That's a wow.
I know. And so I can understand that there's some split homes out there, where some people look and say, oh, you know, I'm not going to do that, and you do that, or what have you. But bottom line, you need to understand that you cannot, a split home cannot exist in heaven. Heaven could not be divided. When heaven was divided, something happened. And those who followed Lucifer were cast out. And so bottom line, I truly believe that we have to be united on the Constitution. I truly believe we have to be united on the principles of liberty and those things that guarantee that. And those people who are being co-opted, because this is a very dark, evil, nefarious process. It is not of Christ. Christ would not create a movement that would drive people away from his Constitution. Absolutely not. It makes no sense. It lacks the consistency that he tells us, look for me and you will recognize me and what I do.
Right.
So anyway, anywho, so my point is that, you know, when it comes down to, you know, winning this battle, I truly believe that just like the Bolsheviks, those who demand to compel everybody and those people who have abandoned the Constitution and tried to go and do their own thing, set up their own government or what have you, I think they fall into the same boat. And they should probably be on boats deported to, you know, the destination of their choice. But I will tell you that the world, when we take this constitutional framework back and when we actually restore our government, our true constitutional government, then we'll actually start seeing the world actually turn its back on the UN, and more states will want, or the people of the world will want to actually come towards our constitution, be admitted into the Union and so forth. So anyway, now we've got about 12 minutes to dive into the Virginia ratification debates. And so let me, if you're ready to do that.
I've got them.
Okay. So folks, when the Virginia ratification debates started, there was a lot of contention. As a matter of fact, this was in June of 1788. And so we're almost a year away from the Constitutional Convention when it occurred and convened in September 1787. And so what we had was a lot of people already going around because the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers were already flying everywhere. And the Anti-Federalists had really galvanized on very specific issues. And one of the biggest issues that they were galvanized on was the lack of authenticity and the lack of authority that the delegates in the Constitutional Convention possessed. So when this convention actually met, before they even, you know, formed themselves, they demanded that they disband because this convention that was at the Constitutional Convention, not the delegate convention, they exceeded their commission. They felt that the Constitution was illegitimate. In other words, that was their hardcore position. You can't, you know, be divided on that. If you believe that they exceeded their commission, then the Constitution is illegitimate.
Are you saying that this is how the Virginia ratification debate started out, that the Anti-Federalists
took this? Pauline Mayer basically points out that in the Virginia ratification debates, they actually had to vote whether they exceeded their commission or not.
Wow.
And the majority of the people that were delegates to debate the Constitution felt that they did not exceed their commission. So right there, go ahead.
Yeah. That communication is not in this document, is it?
No, it's not. However, we're going to find some comments as we read through this when they start talking about the commission. The reason that they're talking about it. And you're going to notice that a part of the response to the Anti-Federalists will be basically saying, look, you know, we've already settled this, and now you keep bringing this thing up. Look, they did not exceed their commission.
Okay.
And so it's going to be way down the road, because the first thing they start doing after they lost this little battle of this, you know, the exceeding the commission, the Anti-Federalists then focus quickly on powers, direct taxes, and a lack of a Bill of Rights. So they then started the assault on the Constitution itself. The first assault was on the delegates at the Constitutional Convention, that they violated their commission, that they went well beyond what they were supposed to do, and so forth. So there's a lot in this particular debate that really helps expose, you know, the framework of the Constitution and the importance of the enumerated powers, the importance of the lack of needing a Bill of Rights. So anyway, we're now on the 4th of June, the beginning of early June, and let me see. Mr. Henry had a motion, and then he basically wanted to, you know, go down this preamble and all of that. Then he withdrew his motion. And so then they proceeded on reading, and then Mr. Nicholas made some comments, and this is his comments regarding jurisdiction. Now, this is George Nicholas, who was really a part of the Kentucky County delegates. Go ahead.
Okay. It is objected, however, as a defect in the Constitution that it does not prohibit the House of Representatives from giving their powers, particularly that respecting the support, et cetera, of armies, out of their hands for a longer term than 2 years. Here, I think the enemies to the plan reason unfairly. They first suppose that Congress, from a love of power natural to all, will in general abuse that with which they are invested, and then they would make us apprehend that the House of Representatives, notwithstanding their love of power, and it must be supposed as great in a branch of Congress as in the whole, will give out of their hands the only check which can ensure to them the continuance of the participation of the powers lodged in Congress in general. In England, there is no restraint of this kind on the Parliament, and yet there is no instance of a money bill being passed for a longer term than 1 year. The proposed plan, therefore, when it declares that no appropriation for the support of an army shall be made for a longer term than 2 years, introduces a check unknown to the English Constitution, and one which will be found very powerful when we reflect that, if the House of Representatives would be prevailed on to make an appropriation for an army for 2 years, at the end of that time, there will be a new choice of representatives. Thus, I insist that security does not depend on the number of representatives. The experience of that country also shows that many of their counties and cities contain a greater number of souls than will be entitled to a representation in America. And yet the representatives chosen in those places have been the most strenuous advocates of liberty and have exerted themselves in the defense of it, even in opposition to those chosen by much smaller numbers. Many of the senatorial districts in Virginia also contain a greater number of souls, and yet I suppose no gentleman will within these walls will pay the senators chosen by them so poor a compliment as to attribute less wisdom and virtue to them than to the delegates chosen from single counties. And as there is greater probability that the electors in the large district will be more independent, so I think the representatives chosen in such districts will be more so too. For those who have sold themselves to their representatives will have no right to complain if they, in their turn, barter away their rights and liberties. But those who have not themselves been bought will never consent to be sold. Another objection made to the small number of representatives is that admitting they were sufficient to secure their integrity, yet they cannot be acquainted with the local situation and circumstances of their constituents. And then this one is emphasized. When we attend to the object of their jurisdiction, we find this objection unsupportable. Congress will superintend the great national interests of the Union. Local concerns are left to the state legislatures. When the members compare and communicate to one another their knowledge of their respective districts and states, their collective intelligence will sufficiently enable them to perform the objects of their cognizance. They cannot extend their influence or agency to any objects but those of a general nature. The representatives will, therefore, be sufficiently acquainted with the interests of their states, although chosen by large districts. As long as the people remain virtuous and uncorrupted, so long, we may fairly conclude, will their representatives, even at their present number, guard their interest and discharge their duty with fidelity and zeal. When they become otherwise, no government can possibly secure their freedom.
Now, so I believe that his little comment towards the end here that I highlighted, or not highlighted, but, you know, it's right here in the very last sentence. As long as the people remain virtuous and uncorrupted. In other words, what he's basically saying, as long as most people look at this as a religious thing, but actually what he's referring to, because what would happen if all of a sudden the people wanting government to do things it has no authority to do, then it's lost its virtue and it has been corrupted because the government is limited to the enumerated powers. This has nothing to do with morality. That virtue is virtually keeping within the enumerated powers, because it is when the people become corrupt and ask government to exceed the powers delegated, then they are, you know, plummeting towards their own destruction. Because that's when you start destroying yourself by allowing government to usurp powers. I mean, Washington said this in his farewell address, that even though by noble intent, you know, when powers are assumed outside the delegation, outside the mode of amending, and they basically can start assuming these, this is how nations are destroyed.
Well, we're seeing that today, aren't we?
Right, but most people, when they hear these expressions, like from John Adams, first off, I don't think John Adams really understood the Constitution, because, I mean, he was one of the first, you know, tyrants to violate it. But and so he lost his virtue because he wanted to constrain, you know, the speech of others, right, and so forth. So that's the whole point, is that when you see these types of words, they may have been, and they're commonly tied to this religious, you know, righteousness of, you know, the people wanting, you know, bowing to God and so forth. Not that we shouldn't be bowing to God, but this is very specific. It is about the Constitution that keep people need to maintain the restrictions of government within those. They need to keep their government within those restrictions that are clearly delineated. Therefore, you know, we have to maintain the enumerated powers and not allow them outside that. So we go on and we actually go past the fifth, and actually, no, yeah, it's the fifth where we hit Pendleton. Mr. Pendleton makes a note and, you know, makes some comments here. So go ahead.
But it is represented to be a consolidated government, annihilating that of the states. A consolidated government which so extensive a territory as the United States cannot admit, if without terminating in despotism. If this be such a government, I will confess with my worthy friend that it is inadmissible over such a territory as this country. Let us consider whether it be such a government or not. I should understand a consolidated government to be that which should have the sole and exclusive power, legislative, executive, and judicial, without any limitation. Is this such a government? Or can it be changed to such a one? It only extends the general purposes of the Union. It does not intermeddle.
Oh, hey, Paul, you can't hear me. Yeah. So, folks, we're heading into the end of this show, and so I apologize. I should have noticed this, and I owe Paul an apology. And believe me, I'll be on my knees tomorrow begging his forgiveness, because I should have realized that we didn't have the time. We talked way too much about the General Assembly. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcasts and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.